This is WNUT Talk on the WNUT Radio Network.
What up, everybody? This is Brandon in the WNUT studios for WNUT Talk. I am also known as Stoney. If you read the description wherever you're listening to this episode and you saw Stoney and then I introduced myself as Brandon, you might go, what the hell? It's same dude. I haven't had an identity crisis. WNUT Talk is a deep dive show where I'm going to kind of go into detail and stories about a particular subject. Today is going to be G-Funk, the G-Funk era. We're talking about West Coast gangsta rap or hip hop, and there was a distinct moment in time. There was a distinct several year period there in the 1990s where the music was classified as G-Funk. We're going to talk about kind of how that came to be. We're going to talk about where that came from. We're going to talk about the rise of it, the commercial peak, and we're going to talk about, you know, kind of how it disappeared, how it went away. Actually, you know, it didn't disappear. We're going to talk about how it fell out of favor, and we're going to talk about all those years. It's still around. I mean, it's the shadow of G-Funk is always hanging out there, which I like. I'm always glad to hear that influence creep into somebody's music or pop up somewhere on the charts. But anyway, you're listening to WNUT Talk one of two ways. And I tell you this, not because I just want to reiterate whatever the hell you're doing. You know where you're listening to WNUT Talk. I want to make you aware of the other way, just in case you don't know. Because either way that you're listening to it, you could benefit from the other one. And that is, number one, you might be listening on Live 365, which you can access on the free Live 365 app. Or Live365.com, where WNUT has a 24-hour-a-day streaming channel. We hit you with full episodes of the flagship show. This show, WNUT Talk, debuts there before it goes to podcast networks. We got a great mix of hand-selected music by me and the other WNUT personalities, and it's never a dull moment at WNUT streaming live 24 hours a day on Live 365. But also, you could be listening on your favorite podcast platform, which might include, you know, Amazon or Spotify or Apple Podcasts or, you know, any of those. YouTube, we put it on the YouTube channel. Those episodes go on demand, streaming at your fingertips, at your convenience, at your beck and call. And so one or the other, if you're listening to one, just, you know, be aware the other exists. You might want to check it out. You know, if you're streaming on Live 365, hey, you don't have to just wait until 10 a.m. or 4 p.m. to hear this show. And if you're listening on your favorite podcast network, you could just turn on WNUT and let it roll in the background. And you never know what'll pop up, including WNUT Talk. And which episode might it be that day? Hey, who knows? This is the 6th episode. We've covered everything from Prince and the time he became a symbol. I've talked about physical media and digging through record stores. We had an interview from the archive with Jimmy Koo, formerly of Andrew WK and the Coup de Grace, and what he's been up to. We expect he will reappear. I've had some recent conversations with him about some things we might bring to you in the future. So there's some exciting stuff on WNUT Talk. Oh, including we had a roundtable discussion of ruining your favorite TV and movies. So that was me, the Great Fishnez, the WNUT intern, and Aguito Live. So you always want to be listening to Live 365. Stay on top of the latest stuff that WNUT is putting out. You can also do that at our YouTube channel, where there's all kinds of great programming that you can just call up at will. You know, but today we're talking about G-Funk, and we're talking about hip-hop. We're going back to the 90s. So why don't we put on our knit caps, you know, in our jean jackets, and let's go back to about 1991 or 1992, and we will talk about G-Funk today. Now, WNUT and G-Funk go way, way back, all the way back to the first episode we ever did back in 1994. The first song we ever played on WNUT was Snoop Dogg's What's My Name, and with all throughout 94, man, we played stuff by Dr. Dre, we played Warren G's Regulate, hell, don't forget about, we opened episode 7 with a parody of Regulate called Constipate, which is another thing streaming on Live 365 or the YouTube channel. You can check it out either of those places. But WNUT has always kind of had a love and a soft spot for G-Funk. We love the sound of that particular you know, blend of hip-hop. But by 1997, we had shifted to a more rock-oriented focus. You know, we were playing alternative, and we were playing metal and grunge and stuff like that, which we had always played that stuff as well. But, you know, that kind of became our focus in 97. We moved away from hip-hop. But by 1998, we were reintroducing it with Insane Clown Posse and even Vanilla Ice, who I might bring him up later. I'm not sure if we go into that part of G-Funk. But anyway, And then in 1999, WNUT and the Jazzman's program, WJAZ, did a one-time crossover event, which we called Bringing Back the G-Funk Era. And we used that double episode event to kind of rail against Master P and his No Limit Records, and we went off on Puff Daddy and just some of the new sounds that had been overtaking hip-hop at that time, which we did not take well to. We didn't like them very much. We longed for the days when Dr. Dre and Snoop Doggy Dogg had carved out their niche and climbed the charts and forged the G-Funk path, and so that's kind of what that was all about. But I will say, the Bringing Back the G-Funk Era two-episode special did kind of degenerate and break down into us promoting this video game wrestling event that we were going to do, but which never actually materialized. So I don't know. There was a lot of potential for Bringing Back the G-Funk Era, but I feel like we squandered it in a way, especially when the thing we were promoting never did get released, and you never could go watch what we were calling the free preview and see those matches. So yeah, Bringing Back the G-Funk Era is there. You can stream both of those episodes on the YouTube channel. And you'll hear a lot of great stuff from Dr. Dre and Warren G. You'll hear some remixes. You'll hear some things that were new at that time that classic G-Funk artists were up to, like Dre and Snoop. But it didn't live up to the hype when it was all said and done. But also, I will say, and I hate to say I told you so, but it turns out WNUT was right about Puff Daddy all along. We did not like him back then, and I think it's safe to say most people do not like him today for a lot of reasons. A lot of those reasons we found out were pretty concrete last year when his homes got raided. So yeah, it turned out that his shallow and self-serving posturing was just the tip of the iceberg. That was the shit we hated back then. We just knew there was something off about that clown, and we tried to warn you. We did. So maybe you were on our side back then. Maybe you defended Puffy. You probably wish you hadn't. But yeah, you can also, you know what happened in Bringing Back the G-Funk Era that still to this day is one of my favorite things WNUT ever did was the Jazzman and Commander Weber teamed up on their own version of Nothing But a G Thing called Ain't No Thing But a Nut Swing. And it was incredible. That is also streaming on the YouTube channel on demand. And we play that regularly on Live 365. So when we talk about G-Funk, when we use the term G-Funk, what the hell does that mean? When we say G-Funk, what are we talking about? We're talking about a sound or a production style in hip-hop that was pretty prevalent from about 91 or 92 until roughly 96 or 97. And you're going to learn soon why these boundaries are kind of, you know, static. They're not firmly drawn, and we're going to get into that a little bit. But the really high-pitched synthesizer, the kind of melody line that floats above the beat and the bass line, and sometimes sounds kind of scratchy or squealing, that to me has always been kind of the defining element of G-Funk. That was a thing that you got in G-Funk that you didn't get in other styles of either gangsta rap or hip-hop or hardcore, you know, stuff. And I'm not saying this is how people define it. This is just what it always was to me. When I heard that, I knew I was in the G-Funk zone. And the sound that I'm talking about, if you want to listen to Dre Day, it's that really high-pitched sort of melody line that floats above everything else. You hear it in Eazy-E's Real Motherfucking G's from 93. By the time Warren G used it in Regulate, it had gotten a little less scratchy. It was kind of smoother sounding. It was more of a polished synth sound by then, but it was something that they did in G-Funk that they didn't do in other types of hip-hop, and that always made it stand out to me. But in broader terms, G-Funk consists of a more laid-back sound. A lot of the songs had slower tempos, and they just had like a more relaxed kind of groove. That was not always the case, but yeah, a lot of time. Deep bass, very prominent snare drum, you know, a very crisp snare sound. We're not talking about like trap music. This predated trap beats where you would hear the rapid fire snare. That was not a thing yet. So these were more natural drum grooves. They almost sounded like something you could play on a drum kit, you know. But a lot of them would be sampled from somewhere or recreated on a drum machine. And of course, the high synth leads that I just mentioned, which would slide between notes. You wouldn't just hear one note and then the next note. It would actually slide back and forth between the higher and the lower notes, like you might hear a theremin, like Think of the Instrument on Good Vibrations by the Beach Boys, or if somebody plays the saw, you know, if they hit the saw and they bend the saw to create different notes, you have to slide up and down. That's what the lead synth sound in G-Funk would do. It slid back and forth between the notes. And then one last element, they were based heavily on samples of synthesizer-based funk from the 1970s, especially the stuff that George Clinton recorded with his groups Parliament and Funkadelic. So you had a stable of musicians that kind of rotated through his world, and all of George Clinton's groups and members and whatnot came to be known as P-Funk, short for those groups' names, Parliament, Funkadelic, or sometimes it stood for psychedelic funk, depending on who you were talking to. But pretty much it was the sound of George Clinton, his bass player Bootsy Collins, keyboardist Bernie Worrell, guitarist Eddie Hazel, and God, dozens of musicians who had played with these guys throughout the years. P-Funk was the sound that G-Funk would come to be based on. So the songs of P-Funk that you would know: Maggot Brain, Chocolate City, P-Funk Wants to Get Funked Up, Bop Gun, Flashlight, even One Nation Under a Groove. Surely you have to know a few of those. And if you don't, do yourself a favor and start Googling, because you are going to be feeling good in no time. That is a hell of a sound. It is infectious. It gets you moving. It gets you feeling good. And so, armed with a library of these samples, somebody changed the sound of hip-hop in the early 90s, and we will get to who did that very soon. Now, G-Funk was a defining part of West Coast hip-hop in the early 90s. It helped set the scene apart from what was happening in New York by producers and DJs and rappers up there, and it helped set the vibe of California being laid back in contrast to the more hardcore and fast-paced New York City sound and vibe. So G-Funk explodes onto the scene in November of 92 with the release of Dr. Dre's solo album, The Chronic, right? I mean, that's how most of us came to know the sound. We heard nothing but a G thing or Dre Day, and nothing was ever the same again, right? Well, let's talk about Dr. Dre for a second, because he started with the World Class Wrecking Crew, but we're not going back that far. So the way NWA kind of came to prominence was in 87, Dr. Dre produced the song Boys in the Hood, which was rapped by Eazy-E, but written by a rapper from a group called CIA, who went by the name of Ice Cube. It was a song that was kind of more honest in its lyrical approach. It was a tale about street life. It was edgier than the braggadocious and the boastful kind of hip-hop that dominated rap at that time. And audiences really hadn't heard anything quite as gritty as that yet, and they started clamoring for more of it. So NWA delivered another single and another single, and finally an album followed that was recorded in 88 and released in January 89 called Straight Outta Compton. NWA would pretty much dominate West Coast hip-hop for a good bit of the late 80s and going on into the early 90s. And the thing is with NWA is a lot of people don't think of them as a super group, but they really should, because all these guys were coming from different kind of hip-hop crews that were orbiting around that area at that time. You had Eazy-E was doing his thing with like Rendezvous, and he had been getting together with some guys and kind of dabbling in music. Dr. Dre, like I said, was with World Class Wrecking Crew before that. Ice Cube with CIA. The DOC came over to write from, oh God, he was in Fela Fresh Crew. Arabian Prince had been working on his own and with several other DJs doing things. And so all these guys came together and formed NWA. And it really was a super group in the sense of how we use that word, but we don't tend to think of it that way. We tend to talk about NWA like it was the launching pad for these artists. And in some ways it was. But a collaboration between that many people with that many different directions and kind of, you know, those approaches to hip hop and the talents that they had, that really can't last forever. And so by 91, the group fell apart, went their separate ways, which we're going to talk about more in a little bit. But the sounds coming off of The Chronic, which was the first music Dr. Dre released after NWA broke up, and Dr. Dre being the driving force behind the NWA's production, everything, The Chronic introduced sounds audiences had not heard before, at least not in that complete a form, and those sounds would come to be known as G-Funk. So the sound up to that time had somewhat been dominated by New York City. New York pretty much ruled hip-hop in the 80s, but you had California on the map since Boys in the Hood came out, along with artists like Ice-T and Tone Loke and Too Short. But if you think about the sound of hip-hop before G-Funk, and if you want to picture what that sounded like, you really have to think like Run-DMC, you got to think Beastie Boys, you got to think LL Cool J, you got to think Public Enemy. And yeah, NWA Straight Outta Compton had gotten really big. Tone Loke had a huge hit with Wild Thing. But you'll see that when you think of that sound, it was often very breakbeat based. And now when I say breakbeats, what am I talking about there? a DJ would take a record, like a funk record or an R&B or a soul record, and they would find a place in that record where either the drummer was playing by himself and the band hadn't come in yet, or he would find a part somewhere in the middle of the song, like maybe the other instruments would lay out and the drummer would kind of change it up a little bit, and he would do a couple of funkier takes on the beat that he had been playing for several measures. And that was called a break beat. That was a point where sort of the music took a break and the drummer was able to do something that was just the drums by themselves, very rhythmic, kind of do something with the groove, and then the band would get back into it. Well, DJs loved those parts of the record because they could take that and then either lay drum machine beats and stuff on top of it and create something very cool and very layered. They would bring in other samples, or they would bring in keyboards. There were any number of ways that a DJ could take elements and create a hip hop track. And breakbeats were a very important foundation of that in the pre-G-Funk days. And so that's kind of the hip hop sound that you're hearing back then. Very famous breakbeats, if you want to look up things real quick. There's a song by the Soul Searchers called Ashley's Roach Clip. You've heard that breakbeat in a million things. James Brown's Funky Drummer is another one. Or the Honey Drippers' Impeach the President. Holy shit. Everything from like Shabba Ranks to Meredith Brooks used the Honey Drippers beat. And yeah, short samples were often used as instruments or chords to make up a loop, but G-Funk was about to change that dramatically. So the boom bap of drum machines was about to get pushed aside, and we were going to shake up the format a little bit. Well, one thing that people don't realize is that there's another seminal G-Funk album from that same time, produced in very close proximity to Dre and his camp, that many say he copped the style of the Chronic from, and they have receipts. And this is not a conspiracy theory. I'm not saying that, like, if you connect the dots, you'll find that blah, blah, blah. This is more a musical case of the chicken and the egg. These two things existed. They were happening. So we're going to look a little bit closer at them, and we're going to dive into that and tell a story you might not be very familiar with. But before we get to that album and that watershed moment, how did we get to G-Funk? We're going to talk about that when we come back right after these messages.
Full episodes at 6, noon, and 8. The best music mix all day. WNUT.
You are back on WNUT Talk, hanging out with me, Brandon, aka Stoney, today. We are talking about G-Funk. We're not currently in 2025, or whenever you may be hearing this. We are back in 1991, 1992. Right now, we are trying to solve an important dispute, and that is, who came up with G-Funk? Where did G-Funk come from? Who was the chicken and who was the egg? You're going to know what the hell I'm talking about here in just a second. So the story is this. When NWA was promoting their final album in 1991, and Dr. Dre was still part of the Ruthless Records family, and Ruthless Records was just the record label that Eazy-E founded when they released Boys in the Hood. You know, they needed their own record label to put this stuff out. Nobody else was going to put out anything that hard-edged at that time. So Eazy-E and his manager, Jerry Heller, founded Ruthless Records. And it wasn't just Eazy-E and NWA. They would sign their own artists. Bone Thugs and Harmony would be signed to Ruthless later on. The DOC, Michelle A, there were artists signed to Ruthless Records, and they and NWA all worked together at the time. And you know, they're all on each other's albums and stuff like that. So Dr. Dre is still a part of that at the time. But while that final album is happening, and while it's being promoted, and while the tour's coming together, there's another wildly underrated and often overlooked group called Above the Law, signed to Ruthless Records, and they're working on their second album called Black Mafia Life. Now, Above the Law was similar to NWA, but with a funkier and more laid-back sound, as opposed to NWA's kind of more frantic and more hardcore sound. So Eazy-E and NWA's manager, I mentioned him, Jerry Heller, he once said about Above the Law that they would have been NWA if NWA had never existed. So people thought highly of Above the Law, but Above the Law existed in NWA's shadow, pretty much. So Dre had produced some tracks on Above the Law's 1990 debut album, which was called Living Like Hustlers. And even NWA had appeared on the final song with them and stuff like that. So, you know, Above the Law was given some real weight. They were given a real push. They were out there with some of the top acts on Ruthless, kind of right out front. And Dre had been listed as a co-producer on that album, though to be fair, the group's contract with Epic Records stated that Dr. Dre had to be listed as a producer to help their album sales. Think of it this way. So Above the Law is on Ruthless Records, but they have a distribution deal with a larger label, in this case, Epic. It was like how NWA was on Ruthless, but they were distributed by Priority. Think about Nirvana. Nirvana is signed to Sub Pop back in the late 80s and early 90s, but they also have a deal with Geffen, and the David Geffen Company is putting out their Nevermind and their In Utero albums, but Sub Pop is still listed on there. They're still a Sub Pop band. Think of it that way. So Above the Law has a contract with Epic that says, we want Dr. Dre to be listed as a producer on this. But as I said, we do know he produced part of that album, right? So we're in the clear. His name's on there. Epic is satisfied. Above the Law's Living Like Hustlers gets out there. An EP follows that in 1991 called Vocally Pimpin'. But by the time Above the Law was working on their second proper album, Black Mafia Life, Dre was busy promoting the final NWA album, making the videos, and, well, it got complicated. We'll talk about that. NWA was preparing for a tour that was supposed to start that fall, but they were also in the process of kind of falling apart over disputes related to money and Jerry Heller's management and other business-related stuff. It's the kind of stuff that, you know, bands and groups kind of get into. A lot of them struggle with this kind of stuff. Some of them successfully navigate through it. Some of them break up over it. NWA was destined not to survive these disputes. And so this was going to result in all kinds of very public feuds over the next 3 years. And diss tracks were going to be aimed at one another. And a good old-fashioned hip-hop rivalry was brewing. Ice Cube had already been firing shots on Death Certificate, which came out that October. Though NWA had provoked him on their 100 Miles and Running EP in 1990, the year before. But suffice it to say, Dr. Dre was not actively producing tracks for Ruthless Records artists at that time. He's busy. But according to Above the Law founder, producer, and member Greg Hutchison, also known by the stage name Cold 187. So when you hear him on a record, he's Cold 187. I will refer to him as Hutchison or his nickname Hutch, which everybody calls him. So anyway, according to Hutch, he played Dr. Dre some of the tracks from Black Mafia Life at the video shoot for NWA's Appetite for Destruction song. And according to Hutch, Dre's response was not just favorable, but Dre was inspired by what he heard. He asked Hutch, how'd you fit that funk into it like that? And he called the new music he was hearing, quote, some next level shit, unquote. Hutch describes it as Dre being proud of hearing this kind of innovation from someone he mentored. Because look, Cold 187 is a guy who, he's not just writing and performing on the records with his group. He's not just a member of Above the Law and writing, but he also aspires to be a producer and to be somebody who's kind of a maestro pulling the strings and making things happen behind the scenes like Dre. And they had worked closely together in the years leading up to the time that we're talking about. So they admired one another. They looked at each other as friends. They worked very closely with, you know, everybody on the Ruthless Records roster. Now, Hutch describes putting these funk grooves into the records he was making at that time, or into the songs that would go on the Black Mafia Life album. He describes that as kind of a counter to what other groups like Gangstar and A Tribe Called Quest were doing with jazz at that time. And these are New York City groups, but so we're talking about these groups are taking jazz samples and they're kind of working them into the music as kind of a signature part of their sound. And Hutch wants the California equivalent to be the funk, or what he's starting to do with P-Funk and those samples. Hutchison wanted to work in full melodies and harmonies into the tracks that he was making, not just a chord or an instrument. He wanted the essence of these funk tracks to be infused with what he was doing, so that both the sample that he brings in from the funk band's record and the beat that he has created in the studio, they both bring something equally important to the track, right? He's not just bringing in like a little stinger sound from a record and using that as an accent. No, he's got the part that he has created himself, and he's got the part that he's bringing in from the past, and those two things are kind of working together. And that's what Dre was excited about. He heard the beat that Cold 187 generated, but he also heard this sample come in and stay there and stick around for a while, but neither one of them competes with each other. They kind of blend together to make this incredible sound, and Dre was reportedly very impressed by that. So if the story is true, how was Dr. Dre able to take what he'd heard Above the Law doing and somehow beat them to the market more than a year after he'd heard it? Well, let's get into some record company politics. Remember the distribution deal that I mentioned that Above the Law had with Epic Records? So Above the Law are ruthless records artists, but Epic is going to promote them throughout the U.S. and to radio and MTV. But it needs the star power of Dr. Dre as a producer on their projects, because this would lend their albums more mainstream appeal, and it would guarantee a higher level of sales. Basically, they knew that if somebody looked at an Above the Law album and saw Dr. Dre's name, they would take them very seriously as artists. They would go, I don't even have to know who this is, but with Dr. Dre's name here, it's almost like he vouches for them. I'm going to give this group a chance. However, when Dre left Ruthless Records in early 1992 to start Death Row Records with, we'll say, his controversial friend Suge Knight, Above the Law's deal with Epic fell apart when Epic realized that Dre was not going to be producing it. He wasn't around anymore. He was not a part of their label. He was not a part of their family. They had had a very public falling out. So Epic shelved Above the Law's album. They weren't going to release it until Above the Law landed at Giant Records, which was a Warner Reprise label, a year later. And it came out in February 1993. Okay, this was a year after it had been ready to go. And so what this did was gave Dr. Dre the better part of a year to work with this production style and to introduce sounds he knew would be brand new to an audience who was looking for something different. And that would be an extension and a natural evolution of what he'd already been doing on records for 3 or 4 years to that point. So it's simple, right? Greg Hutchison invented it, and Dr. Dre cribbed it from him, right? Is it ever that easy? People tend to get caught up in arguing either who named it G-Funk or who arrived at the finished recipe first, however it is a person qualifies what a G-Funk record is. And I think you're getting into the weeds when you argue shit like that. And it usually comes down to people who are big fans of Dr. Dre on one side and they won't hear anything else. Or on the other side, you got people who want to root for a lesser known, kind of an underdog, and they like a good expose story. And, you know, like I said, the conspiracy theory kind of thing. Well, here's what we do know. Whether or not Hutch's claims are true, and we have no reason to doubt him. He and Dre respect each other to this day, and both have had incredible careers in hip-hop. But whether or not, what we can do is track the evolution of G-Funk up to 1991 and 1992 pretty easily. So in 1987, NWA released a 12-inch EP as the follow-up to Boys in the Hood that had Panic Zone, Dope Man, and 8-Ball on it. Dope Man sampled the high-pitched synthesizer from Funky Worm by the Ohio Players. That's the squealing sound I mentioned earlier that would come to be the blueprint for G-Funk's distinctive synthesizer tone, that really high squealing sound. That sampled sound would reappear on Gangsta Gangsta the following year, which was released as a single on September 5th, 1988, and would be on the group's proper debut album, Straight Outta Compton, on January 25th, 1989. So there you go. You got two NWA songs, 87 and 88, that use that distinctive sound, which would come to be a very identifiable component of G-Funk. Later in 89, Dre would produce It's Funky Enough for the rapper The DOC, which was released on June 16th of that year. Now, G-Funk as a genre still does not exist at this point, but this track was looked back on as perhaps the first example of the genre by magazines like Rolling Stone and websites like The Boombox. It's Funky Enough incorporates a sample of Misdemeanor by Foster Silvers from 1973 and further establishes some of the conventions of the G-Funk style. So you've got the deep bass, you've got the prominent snare drum, you've got the funky sample, you've got the more laid-back tempo, and you've got the female backing singers. That's going to come into play in a big way, starting with The Chronic. Think songs like Dre Day or Bitches Ain't Shit. And then later, Doggy Dog World from Snoop Dogg. Although they didn't always need to be female. I mean, Nate Dogg launched his career being an incredible backing singer for some of these G-Funk tracks. So Dre continues to move in that direction on NWA's final album, as well as former NWA member Ice Cube would do on his second album, Death Certificate, which I mentioned earlier. And where do you think he picked it up from? Both those albums were released in 91. Then, as we said, there's a very public falling out. The Ruthless Records family breaks up a little bit. Dre goes on to co-found Death Row Records. He starts working on The Chronic. 1992, there's not a whole lot of action from the NWA folks. But then as 1992 comes to a close, on December 15th, two things arrived. First, Death Row Records. I mean, it had existed for a few months, but, you know, it hadn't been in the public's hands yet. And as of December 15th, it was in the public's hands with the second thing that arrived, which was Dr. Dre's solo debut album, The Chronic. Now, I hate the phrase I'm about to say, and usually I won't say it because 9 out of 10 commercials seem to think it is not fucking played out to refer to their product as this, but I'm going to tell you right now, The Chronic was a game changer. It was a flashpoint after which rap was very different. Its influence was not just felt in California, but I mean, New York felt it, Atlanta, Houston in a big way, Miami felt it. Everywhere that hip-hop records were being made in the early 90s, The Chronic was a point where you can separate hip-hop before The Chronic and hip-hop after The Chronic. It is a full chapter stop in the history of rap music, and it is not to be taken lightly how much The Chronic changed everything. You had the singles Nothing But a G Thing, you had Dre Day, you had Let Me Ride. Those were all not just chart-topping, but dominating singles that year. You had Ice Cube, former NWA member himself, released It Was a Good Day and Check Yourself from the Predator album, fully incorporating the sound he'd already begun working with on his previous album. And it also doesn't hurt that Dre and Cube have reconciled by 1992-93. They're kind of bonding over their dislike of Jerry and Easy, and so Dre's working with them. They actually started work on an album that they were going to collaborate with and make together, which never happened, called Helter Skelter. But anyway, so you go through 92-93, you've got these songs appearing, and then in November 1993, almost a year after The Chronic appeared, Death Row released Snoop Doggy Dogg's debut album, Doggy Style, and its lead single, What's My Name, to carry that influential new sound into 1994, where we would then get Gin and Juice and Doggy Dogg World and all that stuff. And look, this was just the beginning. This was just the spark that lit a G-Funk gas fire, which was about to burn until 96 or 97. Not that the influence would ever go away, but this is the snowball starting to roll downhill, okay? It's clear that whatever happened between Dr. Dre and Above the Law's Hutch in 1991, however they may have influenced one another, G-Funk did not arrive in Greg Hutchison's hands fully formed for him to give to Dr. Dre more than a year before The Chronic came out. This was not like Marty McFly going back in time to give Chuck Berry's sound to Marvin, his cousin, you know? Dr. Dre's work, up to that point, everything Dre had done since Dope Man laid the foundation for this new style. And that's all clearly documented. You can easily trace 5 years of what Dre had been doing in the studio producing leading up to The Chronic. But it is quite possible and even likely that Cold 187, a.k.a. Hutch, provided the final piece of a very multifaceted puzzle to Dr. Dre in 1991 when he played him the tracks from Black Mafia Life. It's very possible that Dre went, okay, cool, that is the missing piece I needed. Everything that I'd done up to this point, I needed that to bring it on home. Think of it like the Joker in the 1989 Batman movie. I'll say I made you, but you got to say you made me. Now, has this ever been confirmed? Hutch has spoken extensively about this for decades. He has told the story time and time again. His story never changes. It stays the same. As do the people who orbited around him at that time. They tell the story the same way. Story's never really deviated. But has Dr. Dre himself ever admitted that he took the last few style elements he needed for G-Funk from what he heard in Above the Law's Black Mafia Life album? No, not explicitly. So that's why the matter is unsettled. That is why the matter is debated. It's just because Dr. Dre has not stepped up and said, yes, I borrowed that, or yes, I took that. It's not that he has ever denied it. He has not. But, you know, he's also never said, yes, all of that is true. That is how this worked out. And it's probably best that he doesn't, to be honest. Now, we know these things. Cold 187 and Dr. Dre worked together again 10 years ago on Dre's Compton album in 2015. It was on the song Loose Cannons with Exhibit. They both appeared on that. The pair remain close friends to this day. We also know that Warren G admitted in a 2013 interview with Hip Hop DX that Cold 187 created G-Funk and that Warren, Dre, and others carried it over into their own work. And Warren G was on The Chronic with Dr. Dre. So that's as close to the horse's mouth as it looks like we're going to get. And think too, Warren G was also one of Dre's guys. And not only that, but he grew up in Long Beach with Snoop as kids. So like everybody is very close here. They're all a close-knit family. Hutch describes Warren G as being like a little brother to him. So these men are basically family. We also know that Tupac appeared on the Above the Law Black Mafia Life album. He was a rookie back then. He had only released one album. It was Tupacalypse Now that had already come out in 91. And Tupac, in his verse on the Above the Law album, calls it G-Funk. And this is being recorded before a note of the Chronic was ever even recorded. The story goes that Tupac asked Hutch what he called the sound, and Hutch told him they'd been calling it G-Funk, Gangsta Funk, as a play on P-Funk. So Tupac replies, "That's hard. I'm going to put that in a rhyme." And the fact that he did is undeniable. You can listen to the song and confirm it. The line is in the song, "Call it what you want," and it goes like this. He says, "Tupac will pack a punch and pump the trunk. I'm bumping G-Funk, but you can call it what you want." And that is on an album recorded a year before The Chronic came out. And I believe that Dr. Dre referenced that song in Dre Day, where he says, "You can call it what you want to. You trip with me, but it's a must that I trip with you. Or fuck with me, but it's a must that I fuck with you." Depends on if you're listening to the radio edit or the album version. But anyway, I believe that Dre referenced that song. Kind of acknowledged that it was hanging out there. Because again, he knows all these people. He's heard this music. No, the album's not out for the public, but Dr. Dre's already had access to this stuff. And he knows Tupac well. I mean, they were going to record California Love together a few years later. So, hey, whatever became of G-Funk? Did the style succeed? Hey, we'll dig into that when we come back. And I think we're going to need an industrial excavator. We'll be back right after this.
Kids playing radio. For 30 years, WNUT.
You are listening to WNUT Talk. I am Brandon. Hell, maybe we'll call it G-Funk Talk today. You're listening to G-Funk Talk because that is the topic at hand. We have talked about the roots of G-Funk. We've talked about where it came from. We've talked about what makes it what it is. What we're discussing right now is who the hell kind of came up with it. Who perfected it? Who put the recipe together? Was it Hutch, a.k.a. Cold 187 of Above the Law, or was it Dr. Dre, the godfather of the Ruthless Records sound? What we've arrived at is there's really no good way to know unless Dr. Dre ever decides to just come clean and say, "Here's exactly how I arrived at the sound on the Chronic." We're never going to know that for sure. But it looks pretty well like Hutch and Dr. Dre both cross-pollinated in their approaches in the studio. They both provided and borrowed things to and from one another, and they might have been the architects of this sound together. But definitely, we can demonstrate that Dr. Dre laid the foundation starting in 1987, and maybe Hutch provided him the final piece. We're not sure, but I just know that we don't have a real answer. So what became of G-Funk? Man, millions and millions of fucking records sold. That is what. And so behind The Chronic and Doggy Style, which we've already kind of talked about, Death Row Records' third number one album and platinum seller was the Above the Rim soundtrack, which featured Warren G's Regulate and the Lady of Rage's Afro Puffs, by the way. Those were both hits in 1994. But Warren G's Regulate was the unstoppable one. After that, Death Row alone released the Murder Was the Case soundtrack, The Dog Pound's Dog Food in 1995, Tupac's final two albums, and Snoop Dogg's second album, The Dog Father, in 1996. They even ended 1996 with a compilation called Christmas on Death Row, which I got back in the day, and it was badass. But Eazy-E wasn't going to take Dre Day lying down. Dre took some shots at him. As I said, you know, the breakup of N.W.A. caused some feuds in hip-hop and some diss tracks. And Dre Day, while being a badass G-Funk song in and of itself, was also, god damn, was that. That was just Dre running over Eazy repeatedly. I mean, he was just dunking on Eazy in that song time after time after time. So Eazy responded with the It's On EP in 1993, led by Real Motherfucking G's, which became a hit. You can't have the word motherfucking in a big hit song, so it was called Real Compton City G's, if you heard it on the radio or MTV. But he answered Dr. Dre in that song, and it's my opinion, it's kind of a lesser example of G-Funk, but it's close enough for government work, you know? I mean, he's Easy E after all. You got to give him a pass. It was just a weaker G-Funk sound. It was a little anemic compared to what Dre had just dropped on the Chronic. But hey, like I said, he's Easy. Overall, the EP is a good one. And remember, Above the Law were Ruthless Records artists, as were Bone Thugs and Harmony, who Easy discovered. So Easy E was going to profit from a lot of G-Funk before his death in 1995. Including the music Dre was releasing on Death Row that shit-talked Easy himself. He had a contract where he would continue to make royalties off of Dre's releases no matter what label put them out. And so to paraphrase the lyrics to Real Motherfucking G's, they tried to fade me on Dre Day, but Dre Day only meant Easy's payday. And that shit was no joke. Like I said, Warren G released the Regulate song off the Above the Rim soundtrack. That song would be not just the lead single from that soundtrack, but Warren G's debut album, Regulate the G-Funk Era, which came out on June 7th, 1994. And in my opinion, may have been kind of the peak of the genre as a sound that you could not escape. The Regulate single was everywhere. And let me tell you, as somebody who loved G-Funk, even I got fucking sick of Regulate for several weeks that summer. I ain't shitting you. This one blew up. And music fans across the spectrum, no matter what you liked, this album was approachable in a way that the Chronic and Doggy Style may have been a little less so to the public at large. And it yielded two top 10 hits, another one in the Hot 100. And the Regulate the G-Funk Era as an album was triple platinum by 1995, certified by the RIAA. Moving further in that accessible direction, Coolio came out with It Takes a Thief on July 19th, which kind of imbued the hardcore and the most certainly gangsta subject matter and approach with a little lightheartedness and some SoCal fun. And that included his breakout G-Funk hit Fantastic Voyage, and also went platinum later that year. Even MC Hammer, then simply known as Hammer, he got in on the craze, man. He released the Funky Headhunter on March 1st, 1994, and Hammer started incorporating G-Funk into his style. Now, while that may seem a bit jarring, Hammer and Tupac had become great friends by this time, writing and collaborating together from time to time. Hammer would even sign with Death Row in 1995, which is something a lot of people don't know. And Hammer recorded an album on the label called Too Tight, which featured Tupac on a song, but that album remains unreleased to this day. It did leak several decades ago. We here at WNUT do have the album. I actually kind of think it was one of Hammer's better albums, you know, post Too Legit to Quit. But anyway, I digress. I'm not supposed to have heard that. Hammer was even in Las Vegas with Tupac on the night of his death. So yeah, it makes sense that Hammer would cross over into G-Funk and would kind of, you know, rub shoulders with some of the Death Row folks. Speaking of Tupac, his third album, Me Against the World, began incorporating the sound in 1995. And at the end of the year, he and Dr. Dre released California Love, which I mentioned earlier, Tupac's debut single for Death Row Records, which would be nominated for a Grammy for Best Rap Performance and stands today as possibly one of, if not the best known G-Funk songs of all time. Who the fuck didn't like that song? I mean, I didn't get tired of that one like I did Regulate, and I've made peace with Regulate. To this day, I love Regulate, but California Love, man, you could crank that song up in church and the preacher would throw his hands in the air. That song was amazing. Anyway, Tupac's next album, All Eyes on Me, would prove to be the last one he ever released in his lifetime, but it went to number one. It was certified diamond in 2014, which means 10 million copies sold. Now, on a technicality, All Eyes on Me was a two-disc set, and two-disc sets count it basically as every one that is sold counts as two. You know, because it's a double, right? So you've sold 5 million copies, but there's technically 10 million discs out there. It's weird. That album sold 5 million copies, but it's still certified diamond as if it is a 10 million seller. It, like I said, it's a technicality with doubles. Anyway, Ice Cube had a supergroup called West Side Connection. They released the Bow Down album in October of 96. That album went to number two on the Billboard chart and was also certified platinum. And then, you know, you're getting into 97 here. Warren G finally puts out his second album in 97 called Take a Look Over Your Shoulder. Only took him 3 years to work on it. It didn't exactly set the world on fire, but it did bubble under the top 10. It hit number 11. It spawned two top 40 singles, but You know, by this time, G-Funk was sort of in decline in popularity, and it wasn't heating up MTV like it once had in the charts. You know, it wasn't as inescapable as it might have been in previous years. But you have to think, too. Okay, so it's 1997. We've had three or four strong years of G-Funk by this point. What's going on in 97? Well, you've got Master P coming out of New Orleans with No Limit Records. He releases Ghetto D in the summer of 1997, and the Make 'Em Say Uh song, That was a whole new sound. That was going to be the new direction. That was the new image in hip hop, just like the Chronic and Nothing But a G thing had been just about 5 years before. So No Limit Records was not just leading the new pack, but they were making movies, which, yeah, they were released straight to video, but that's just more product for Master P to sell to people. And buy it they did. And of course, he was releasing the soundtracks to those movies. And so those became, you know, high sellers. And all the liner notes to the albums that came out on No Limit were basically billboards for an endless parade of new albums, new artists, and new sounds. And so where Death Row had released about, you think about, you know, two albums a year, right? Like Death Row would release two albums a year and would focus highly on those. There were years where No Limit was sometimes putting out 20 to 25 albums in the same year. So you can't really focus on these artists with the same laser accuracy that Death Row had done. No Limit was just saturating the market. And that was kind of their strategy. Just choke everybody with No Limit. No Limit everywhere. The brand was the star. Money was the message. The word bling would enter the lexicon. Diamond-studded No Limit logo chains were the accessory people wanted to wear now. And up in New York, the Puff Daddy machine was in full swing. So you got just months after Notorious B.I.G. was murdered in L.A., Puffy releases his debut album called No Way Out. And look, what I'm about to say is going to come off as cynical, but I don't really give a fuck anymore. It didn't just have the exploitative tribute to Biggie, I'll Be Missing You, but the new rallying cry of hip-hop, kind of as it moved, you know, towards the 21st century, was the single It's All About the Benjamins. So at least on that point, No Limit and Bad Boy Records were in lockstep. And look, like I said, I know this sounds cynical about Puffy and Bad Boy. And if I do, it's only because he's one of the worst human beings ever to achieve power in the music industry. This dude sucks. So I can be cynical about him. I don't give a damn. From laying his useless mumbling and grunting over the talented B.I.G.'s records. Like, you listen to Notorious B.I.G.'s Ready to Die, and that album is a masterpiece in hip-hop. I don't care what you like. Ready to Die is some next-level shit. But you have Puff Daddy the whole time in the background going, oh, yeah, I just want to crawl into the speaker and choke him. I would kill for somebody to remaster or remix, I guess, technically, Notorious B.I.G.'s two albums that he released when he was alive, and just take Puffy's mic track completely off. I would pay whatever you asked if I could just get those without him on them. So yeah, from that to sexually abusing and exploiting and even trafficking human beings against their will, and just abusing his far-reaching power and his influence, fuck him, and fuck him least of all because he, you know, replaced G-Funk with his shallow and incoherent bullshit. Fuck him for a lot of reasons. So yeah, these things were on the way up, and G-Funk, which had just had a 5-year run, solid run, but it was on its way down, which is, you know, it's not to say that it ever died. Like I said earlier, you got artists like Tech N9ne from Kansas City. He would use the sound in the early 2000s and later. Warren G would revive it in the 2000s on Return of the Regulator. Even in the 2010s, rappers like Kendrick Lamar, Nipsey Hussle, and others, Schoolboy Q, would kind of infuse some G-Funk into their sound. And this is to say nothing of the fact that in its heyday, G-Funk spread from California to other scenes across the country. Houston had a huge hip-hop scene. I mean, the Ghetto Boys adopted that sound for the Resurrection album, and other artists kind of in their circles, you know. So I just mentioned Notorious B.I.G. And on Ready to Die, he did his own take on the style with Big Papa in 1994. So what do people consider the end of the G-Funk heyday? Like, what kind of ended its streak? In my eyes, and kind of as I witnessed it, it was when Tupac died. I really don't know if this is the conventional wisdom. I don't know if people agree with that or if there's kind of a chorus of voices that say, you know, 40 different things killed G-Funk. I have no idea. But when I think of the end of G-Funk, to me, it died with Tupac. let's look at 96 for a second. In March of that year, Dr. Dre had left Death Row to go form his own label, Aftermath. Then on September 13th, Tupac dies 6 days after he got shot in Vegas. And then in November, a couple things happened. First off, Tupac's final album under the name Machiavelli came out on the 5th. And then on the 26th, Dr. Dre released the Aftermath compilation album. And the Aftermath album sort of began his shift toward the more sparse and the string-based production style that we would soon hear a lot more of when he put out 2001, or Chronic 2001, as people call it. But like I said, G-Funk did not go away. It didn't die off. It, you know, the streak came to an end. But look at all the artists that I just mentioned who have continued to bring that influence into their sound and will continue to do so. And think about the, probably thousands of tracks that were released in the early to mid-90s that you never even heard or don't remember that you heard, where that was the sound they were using. I mean, how many one-hit or no-hit wonders came and went in that time using that sound? And the ones we remember are the ones who did it the best. That's just the way that music is, you know? So, like I said, it didn't die. And I don't think it really ever will. You still have people putting out stuff in kind of the classic 80s styles and stuff. These things get in people's hearts and they kind of get in people's, you know, production blood, so to speak. And they live on. Now, if I had to pick my textbook example of what represents G-Funk, it's Dre Day. To my mind, the genre has never been in as pure a form as on that track from The Chronic, the first track on the album. I'm not talking about like the intro and shit, like the none of that stuff. I'm talking about like the first proper song on The Chronic is Dre Day, and that to me is still the epitome of what G-Funk is. I think the drum sound, the synth, the passion of the singer, Juelz, going on in the background, all of that is amazing. That song nailed it. And I don't think anything, I'm not saying I don't think anything's ever been as good. I just don't think anything's ever topped it. And so there you go. It's Dre Day, or Fuck with Dre Day, and everybody's celebrating. Depends on which title you want to go by. Again, radio edit or LP version. I'll tell you this, though. I have a newfound respect for Above the Law and for their Black Mafia Life album, which had flown under my radar until just recently. And I lived for G-Funk. So I thought the story might be a revelation to some other folks who were interested as well, because it definitely piqued my curiosity. Before I go, I wanted to tell you guys about a pretty cool G-Funk memory that I have. This involves Zach, who's also another WNUT personality that you have heard on episodes 22 and 23 back in 2003 with us. Me, him, Eric, and Carl did a couple of episodes, and Zach was on both of them. But about 10 years before that, in 1993, he was staying over with me one weekend. And, you know, we were in middle school at the time. I think we were 13. And I asked my mom if we could go to the mall, if she would take us to the mall, because we can't drive yet, obviously. And she says, yeah, but you've got to finish raking the yard. Like, I can't remember. I think I was supposed to have done that the week leading up to that weekend, and I hadn't yet. And she's like, I'm not taking you anywhere until you rake the yard. And we had a huge yard, like huge front yard. So me and Zach are like, we really want to go and shop music stores, right? So I look at Zach and I'm like, you think we could do this? And he's like, oh God, yeah. So he takes a rake. I take a rake. We take my little portable stereo out to the front of the house and we crank up Dr. Dre's The Chronic. We jack the volume up. I think my mom had gone somewhere else, you know, so it didn't matter that all the swearing was going on. And me and him got that whole fucking yard finished before the album was done. But man, here's two white kids with long hair, ripped jeans, and metal tees in the middle of nowhere in South Carolina. And that music fucking spoke to us, man. So I love how universal it is. I love that it doesn't matter what your background is, no matter what you're into, that this stuff can speak to us, man. It can still have something to say. And did we make it to the mall? Hell yeah, we did. And what did I buy? I don't know, probably Two Live Crew. Hey, G-Funk hadn't permeated the music yet, man. It's also entirely possible I bought some Prince, some Pearl Jam, some Nirvana, some Metallica. Man, I was 13 and it was the early 90s, so yeah. You are listening to WNUT Talk. Thank you for joining us again, wherever you are listening to this. If it's not Live 365, go check us out on Live 365. Just download the free app or go to live365.com and search WUT. Also, check out our YouTube channel for full episodes of not only this, but the flagship WNUT show, the Jazzman's WJAZ, the Great Fish News' WNUT After Dark. They are all streaming on demand at your fingertips. We will be back next time when the subject, as always, will be, I don't freaking know. We will find out together on WNUT Talk.